Welcome to the podcast, Speaking to Influence, Communication Secrets of the C-Suite. I'm Dr. Laura Sokola, your host, and our focus is on mastering communication as an essential leadership skill so that you can command the room, connect with the audience, and close the deal in any context. After over 200 episodes, we are a top 1% podcast globally, thanks to you. So if you love listening to these conversations as much as I love bringing them to you, please take 30 seconds to leave us a five-star rating and review on your platform of choice, or check out ratethispodcast.com/influence and follow their super simple instructions. On with the show. My guest this week is Reed Phillips. He is the CEO of Oaklands, DeSilva, and Phillips. He's also the author of Quick Value, Discover Your Value and Empower Your Business in 3 Easy Steps, which was published by McGraw-Hill. He's been 35 years in investment banking, and he's joining us today. Reed, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you, Laura. I'm delighted to be with you.
Now, what's a fun fact about you?
Well, for the very first time, I'm going to join the ranks of remote workers, and I'm going to work from California for the month of July.
And where are you normally?
Normally, I'm in Manhattan in New York City. And part of the fun fact is, even though my wife doesn't think it's fun, is I'm going to drive from New York to California, and I'm going to drive back.
Wow.
She, of course, is not going to join me. She's going to fly both ways.
Understood. Where in California will you be?
Dana Point, just south of LA and kind of near Newport Beach and Laguna Beach.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it should be really nice.
And are you visiting somebody important, or you just want to escape from New York as far as possible? And that's about as far as you could get and still be in the continental U.S.
That's true. My wife's originally from LA. She grew up there and went to college in California. And so it'll be nice for us to get back and spend some time there.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Well, I'll expect a full report when you come back a month from now.
Okay.
And that's a long drive. I've made it before, back and forth.
Oh,
both
you have?
Ways. Yes.
Okay.
I did.
Yeah.
When I was right out of college, my very first job was in Los Angeles. Well, my first real major job was in California. I'm a Jersey girl originally. So dad and I packed up my little two-door Toyota Tercel, if that tells you how far back it was, and all my earthly belongings. And we made the trek in about 3.5 days. Then we did it again about 3 years later. So yeah, all the hamsters were running really fast in that little engine.
Yeah, I've booked 5 days each way. So
I think that's smarter if you're doing it by yourself.
Maybe a little more leisurely. Yeah.
Yes, for sure. Well, now tell us about Oaklands, DeSilva, and Phillips. What's your 30-second elevator pitch?
Oaklands, DeSilva, and Phillips is an investment bank for companies that are focused on media, marketing, and technology. We've been around for 30 years. I'm one of the co-founders. I started the company. And in that time, we've completed 400 M&A transactions.
Wow.
And we're also part of a global group, Oaklands, which has 800 investment bankers in 40 countries, and we collaborate with them on deals around the world.
That's truly international, isn't it? That's amazing.
Yeah, and it makes it fun because, I mean, I've been to a lot of places I wouldn't have been, including Mumbai and Marrakesh and even Australia, Singapore, Thailand. It's been a lot of fun.
So you've had a lot of pages added to your passport.
That's exactly right. Yep.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Now, in all of these travels, what's the most important leadership communication that you had to learn, and how did you learn it?
I think the most important lesson has been to be transparent with colleagues and employees.
Mm.
I've kind of observed early in my career companies that aren't that way. I've even worked for companies that are not transparent. In fact, they try to even compartmentalize information so that it's not shared with everybody. It's like, you only need to know this, so that's what you're going to learn. And since we started our company 30 years ago, we've really approached it the opposite way. We've had full transparency, and we have staff meetings with our 25 full-time people and 25 senior advisors every Monday for an hour. We share everything with them. They know every client we're working with. They know what our fees are going to be, how much we're expecting to sell the company for, which stage of this process we're in. And that's just how we approach it. But I did have a funny experience in investment banking when I first started. We were selling a small company in the Midwest, and the two owners were very, very secretive, a husband and wife. And every time we would call, they would go into a private room, close the door at their company, have the conversation with us about the deal, and thought they were being very secretive so their employees wouldn't know what was going on. Later on, once the deal closed, we learned that the staff, as soon as they closed the door, the staff knew something was up. they had some ability to kind of listen in on the calls on a speakerphone, and the staff would just sit there and listen to everything that was being said about the potential transactions. So they knew as much as the owners did.
So they were transparent. They just didn't intend to be.
Inadvertently transparent. Exactly.
Oh, my goodness. And how did the staff respond to that? Or how did you find out that they knew?
I can't remember how we found out, but I think the staff was always distrustful of the owners. Mm. That's probably why they felt they could listen in. And there were probably other interactions with the owners that made them distrustful.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of maybe what happens when you are secretive with your employees.
Yeah. And if they weren't distrustful beforehand, they certainly were afterwards.
Absolutely.
That's one of those situations where the executive assistant or something happened to accidentally pick up and hear part of a call, then sit there and listen for a lot longer and then start telling others, hey, psst, you got to come in here and listen to this. And wow.
Yeah. It's like the old story about Xeroxing something that you weren't supposed to share with everybody and leaving your original on the Xerox machine so the next person comes in and finds it, right?
Yes, yes. The early version of that kind of grapevine. Yikes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, tell me about a time when you made the wrong call and had to fix it. Who did you approach first and what did you say to them?
I did make a wrong call early in my career. My second job, I became a manager and I had a couple of people reporting to me. And I needed to hire a new person to replace someone who was leaving. And at that time, I got a resume from someone who had just graduated from Stanford Business School with their MBA. And I thought, well, you know, this person must be qualified. And so I interviewed him and he ended up joining the company. And very quickly, it became apparent that he thought that this was a chance for him to learn the business. And he went around and talked to everyone in the various departments. And he was just not focused on his job, which was not to learn about what the whole company was doing, but really to do work in the department that we were in. And I talked to him about it, but he never really changed his ways. He was kind of arrogant about it. So I realized I was going to have to fire him. So that would be the first person I hired and the first person I fired. And I was a little nervous about it because I thought it made me look bad.
Right.
So I went around and I talked to my bosses and I talked to some of the other department heads. And I just explained the problem and said, I made a mistake. I hired this person and he's not working out and I'm going to have to let him go. And everybody was in agreement. So it worked out fine. I mean, even when I did let him go, he went and talked directly to the owner of the business to complain, but the owner was already in sync with me letting him go.
Sure. And it's interesting because him going straight to the owner kind of reinforced exactly what you'd been complaining about, that he was kind of overstepping boundaries and just thought he could do whatever he wanted, whenever he wanted.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, I've kind of followed his career a little bit, and he eventually became a consultant. So, I guess he could just learn about businesses and tell people, whatever he wanted to tell them about how to fix the businesses. So he maybe was interested in that right from the start.
Yep. And it sounds like it was more of his calling anyway.
I think so.
And I'm sure, tell me if I'm wrong, but I don't think what someone's supposed to take from this story is that you shouldn't want to learn about the business. It's good
Absolutely
when employees
not.
Want to learn about the
Absolutely
business on the
not.
Whole, understand more how it works, what they do, but then do the job that you're hired to do. Don't walk in there like you're just going to take over tomorrow.
Yeah. I mean, we have core values in our company. One of them is to be curious. We want people who want to learn about everything. But on the other hand, we don't want people who are so curious that they get sidetracked from doing the job that they have to do. You know what I mean? So it's a balance. It's a balance.
Right. I mean, ultimately, you're hired to do a particular job.
Right.
Your curiosity should empower that, distract from it.
Yeah, exactly. Well said. And I mean, if anything, it should make you better at doing your job because you are curious and you want to learn what the whole picture looks like and how you fit in.
Right, exactly. Be part of that team. Don't just hijack it. Now, what about an opportunity that you missed because you held back? Why did you hold back? And if you could have a do-over, what would you do or say differently?
When I was in college, I went to college at Duke University and I had run track in high school. And I was good. I performed well and I could have run in college. but I didn't want to because I was doing other things. But I participated in an intramural track event, and the Duke track coach, who's very well known, Al Buehler, was there watching the races and everything, and he had been an Olympic track coach also. My event in high school was one time around the track, 400 meters now, and for the intramural event, ran half that, 200 meters. Mm. And I could do that at a full sprint and not get winded, but you can't do the 400 meters. That's a killer. That's like considered the hardest race, I think, in track, because it's a full sprint, but you have to save enough energy to make it to the finish line. Mm. And so the coach asked me to join the track team after I ran the 220. And I just automatically made a very bad assumption. I just figured, oh, as soon as he knows that I ran the 440 in high school, you know, one time around the track, that's what he's going to want me to do. And I don't want to do that, you know, because it's really, really hard. Mm. But if I had had the chance to do 200 meters, you know, halfway around the track, that would have been really, really interesting and fun and challenging, a challenge that I probably would have accepted. But I just didn't even think at the time to kind of negotiate with the coach and say, well, yes, I would be interested. This is what I'd like to do, instead of just having the coach tell me what I was going to do. I wasn't thinking that way. And that's a regret that I have even now, well after college.
My brain just went in about 14 different directions. Number one, it's like, not only didn't you negotiate it, you didn't even ask. And right?
Isn't it funny? No, no.
We just go into these assumptions of, oh, this person would probably ask me to do this or would probably make me do that. And I don't want to do that. So, and we just, it's like, oh, if I ask that person out, they'd probably just say no. So I'm not even going to invite them to go to. There's so many things we talk ourselves out of under assumptions. We don't even make the ask to find out what they say. And then if we get the no, or we get the, yes, we want you to run the 440, to then negotiate and say, well, how about the 220 instead, or in addition, or something like that. Any advice for people as far as when that notion of negotiation is a sticking point? Some people are just very uncomfortable at the prospect of having to negotiate anything. It's like, nope, I don't negotiate prices. I don't want to haggle when I'm at a bazaar in whatever country or place. Just sticker price, I pay for it. I don't like negotiating. How do you get past that?
I think, first of all, it's just through experience and doing it. Second, it's realizing it's a conversation. It's not going to be something that's necessarily confrontational, and that they want to get something and you want to get something. And that's a fair exchange. But I think it's very important. And this is what I should have done when the coach asked me if I wanted to join the team. I shouldn't have responded immediately. I should have said, that sounds interesting. Tell me more about it. And then I could have also said, let me take a day to think about it and come back to you. But instead, I just answered right away and cut off all my options. Instead of, like you said, there were many other options that I could have explored, but I cut them all off by saying no quickly. So I think it's really important to listen to the other side in any negotiation, hear what they want out of it, how to compare that with what you want, and try to find the middle ground where it's going to work for everybody.
And I bet with Duke, there would have been, or a potential scholarship involved, there could have been...
Probably, no, my roommates were both, I was in a triple freshman year, and they put you together with people that have similar interests. So both of my roommates were on the track team, and one of the guys ran the same event I had run in high school. And that was another reason why I quickly said no, because I didn't want to be competing with my roommate in the same event. That would have been awkward.
It could have been, and yet something else to negotiate, right?
Especially since when I did the race, he let me borrow his spikes that I wore on the track so that I could run faster instead of using regular shoes. So I didn't want to go back to the dorm room and say, oh, by the way, I'm your new teammate. And not only that, you and I are going to be competing for a position on the team in the same event.
All the things that we talk ourselves out of.
Right, exactly.
Figuring out how to work around it and what's a win-win for everybody. How do we make this work?
Right.
And you know what else is interesting to me about that, Reed, is that now, you know, you figure it's been, let's say, 20 years or maybe a little bit longer since then. And yet it still sticks, right? Those regrets stick with us, no matter how big or small, for whatever reason, that's one of those, they stick. So to not have them, have those conversations, have those negotiations. And I love that. I think the nugget out of that is that negotiation doesn't have to be confrontation. It's just conversation.
Right. Well said.
That's really what I'm taking out of this. So hopefully everybody got that
But I do agree with you, and I will even say what we do for a living as investment bankers is negotiate. And I have colleagues who come to me and say, could you just step into this conversation and do the negotiation for me because I'm uncomfortable? And I don't mind at all. I mean, I'm very comfortable doing it, but I know what's going on. They don't want to get in an adversarial kind of position with the person on the other side. And I do it, and I'm still friendly with everybody. I mean, it may be a little rough in some circumstances where you just have to hold your ground. But in the end, I think the most important thing is just don't think of it as a negative conversation. Think of it as, let's work something out that works mutually for both of us.
Right.
And it's not like I win and you lose.
Exactly. When we look at negotiations as being zero sum, for me to win, you have to lose. That's definitely a way to ensure that it's going to be unpleasant as opposed to figuring out how to make the win-win for everybody. I think that's a great takeaway also. And to the extent that people find that challenging, I'm going to stick with that theme and read this as an opportunity for you to challenge our listeners for the 24-hour influence challenge. Please talk to our listeners and challenge them to take one step that they can complete within 24 hours to have more influence.
One of the things I do in my business is we bring on people who haven't been investment bankers before. They've been operating executives in the industries that we're in. And they've done a lot of deals, but they haven't really been in the role of an investment banker. So one of the things I tell them when I interview them is, if you have any uncertainty about whether you can make the transition, go talk to two or three industry colleagues that are friends and put them in a hypothetical position. If I was an investment banker, would you hire me to sell your company? And listen to the feedback you get, because people are pretty much going to tell you whether or not they think they would trust you to sell their company or not. And they may say things right away like, well, you don't have enough experience yet. I'd be hesitant. So the challenge for listeners is to really think about doing the same thing about any challenge they have. Go to two or three people that know them well. And for example, you might say, would you buy services from my company? Would you buy a product from my company based on the relationship we have? And get a sense of how people think about you on the other side of the table when it comes to those kinds of decisions. And you can get really interesting feedback that maybe you can use to kind of correct things that you were not even aware were a problem.
So I want to ask for clarification on one point there. I love the idea of getting that feedback from somebody who's already in the industry or in the space that you think you might want to transition into. You said, would you buy X from me, or would you hire based on the relationship that we have? It's not about, do we know each other well enough that you'd buy from me, so much as based on our relationship, what you know of me, do you think I have what it takes kind of a thing? Or what qualities do I have? Or what am I missing?
That's right. It's not just based on the relationship, exactly. It's really based on whether I have what you need and I can deliver to you what you need.
Because of our relationship, you know me pretty well. So based on that relationship, make an assessment as to whether or not I have what it takes, et cetera. No, I think that's great. All right, everybody. So find a couple people, and not just people who like you and love you and whatever. They have to like you enough to be honest. Let's put it that way, where they will also tell you the harder stuff as opposed to just what they think you want to hear. I think that can be a challenge from time to time as well. All right. Reed, tell me about a communication skill that you weren't born with and had to learn. How did you develop that skill?
You know, when I was in high school, I was somewhat frustrated, and it was because I was perceived as being maybe quiet, shy, and it was because I just felt that if I didn't have anything to say, don't say anything. You know, if I don't have anything important or relevant, I just wasn't good at small talk at that time. And I realized later that that was really hindering my relationships with other people. And one time that it was, you know, very apparent was in my second job. I was at a political magazine, The New Republic in Washington, D.C. And I joined the week that Ronald Reagan was elected president, and they were having all these inauguration parties around the city. The New Republic is a liberal magazine, so they decided to have an inaugural party for liberals that weren't going to be going to Ronald Reagan's inaugural party. And interestingly enough, the owner of the magazine was well-connected. So he's very good friends with Henry Kissinger. So Henry Kissinger was at the party. Andy Warhol was at the party. And this was in my very first week. And so I was kind of amazed, but I was also intimidated and didn't think I had anything worth saying.
Sure.
So I just didn't introduce myself or say anything. I just kind of gawked from the sidelines like a lot of other people. But over time, I've really kind of gotten over that. And now I can say that in the last month or so, I've met the King of Spain when he was at a conference here in New York. I met creator and producer of television shows like Outlander and spoke to him for 10 minutes and, you know, had a lot to kind of share. In fact, after the conversation, I thought of many more things I could have shared. But, you know, it was just interesting to meet people like that and be able to have an exchange with them where I have something to offer in addition to what they're offering.
It's funny. I love the expression that the King of Spain who was in town for a conference, I thought to myself, do kings have conferences? Like, do they get together? Like, how do you rule your kingdom? How do you rule your kingdom? That was a funny image. Do they do it at the Javits Center or where? What kind of places would they be holding their conference? But my question for you then is, how you made the leap, because if you were shy, not just in high school, but early career, didn't make, and it wasn't even necessarily about small talk, but sometimes a little bit of small talk can crack the door open necessarily, but just to enter the conversation, how do you start it? How do you make those introductions? So many people get stuck on that. And of course, now you're comfortable to talk to the King of Spain, talk to these producers, et cetera, these TV show creators. What was in between the two? What's something that you tried or something that helped you get over yourself? Get over that fear and just try to initiate those conversations.
Yeah, I think some of it's just life experience. I have enough things that have happened in my life in terms of people I've met that I can share that with other people and it can be interesting. And I can make connections like, you know, years ago I met Warren Buffett. I didn't have a lot to say to him at that time because I was still intimidated. But these days I've met the founder of thestreet.com that has the television show, Jim Cramer, and met him at a cocktail party. And we talked for 10, 15 minutes.
Wow.
One of my former bosses was his partner at thestreet.com. So we could talk about that. I always look for commonality, common ground in terms of my background and their background. And even before I do a Zoom call and I'm meeting somebody new, maybe a prospective client, I'll look at their LinkedIn profile and just try to find the areas of commonality where I can share some stories. And that works really well in terms of kicking off the conversation and making it a nice exchange rather than me trying to perhaps sell somebody on something.
Right. I think anytime you go into a conversation from a transactional standpoint, it's just going to tank from there because people can smell a sales pitch a mile away. But just initiating that conversation for its own sake sometimes is an art form unto itself.
Yeah, so I think it's a combination of having more experience, more stories, and feeling I have something to share with the other person regardless. And to some degree, you find as you do this that the people on the other side of the table that are celebrities are just people too. They have all the same concerns we do, and they care about the same things we care about. You can have a really interesting conversation.
What advice would you give your
younger self?
23-year-old self, before you have all those big experiences and professional notches on your belt, so to speak, what would you tell your just newly minted professional self?
You know, I think the biggest fear was being embarrassed that I would say something stupid. I would say my advice would be to get over that. And maybe one time out of 10, you will say something that's awkward and it won't go well, but you'll get better and better at it. And pretty soon it'll be one time out of 100, and then it'll be one time out of 1,000. So you just have to do it.
Right. All right, everybody, whoever out there is relating to the 23-year-old Reed, there's your advice. There's your marching orders. Finish the sentence for me, Reed. I wish I was better at explaining what to whom.
Well, we work with clients who are selling their companies, and most of our clients are selling for the very first time. So it's a process that they don't understand. So what we try to do, and I try to do, is try to simplify the process for them and demystify the process. So I explain it in a way that it sounds not complicated and pretty straightforward. In reality, though, it's not a straightforward process.
What process are we talking about?
Selling your company. If you're a founder of a company and you decide to sell it and you hire us as your investment banker to manage the sales process, we know how complicated it is. We know what all the pitfalls are that can occur along the way. And sometimes we share a little bit of that, but going into it, most of our clients don't have any understanding of how complicated it's going to be. And a lot of times by the time it's over, people call it kind of a roller coaster, you know, highs and lows and getting psychologically kind of involved in the process, like, oh, well, these guys changed the price and made it lower. They must not like me or they don't like my business. And so that's what the process is. It's kind of harrowing. and it would be nice if I could explain to clients what it's going to be like. Mm. I don't think they would believe me in the beginning. I think what happens instead is you have to start experiencing things. And then as you experience them, then I can talk to them about how other people have gone through this. It's not unusual, and bring some comfort at that point. And for the most part, we're working with entrepreneurs selling their company for the first time, and they haven't been through the process before, and they are going to really experience all the ups and downs that go along with it.
Yes. So it sounds like you have to be able to explain something simply enough that it sounds achievable and that they can wrap their heads around it to say, yes, not oversimplifying or sugarcoating, so to speak, but just enough, and then little by little be able to unravel it as necessary. Because I think when you're too technical or too specific in the beginning, you hear words, or at least I hear words, and it's not until I get to that point that I go, oh, that's what you meant when you said this. They don't have real meaning yet.
Right. Or they might think, oh, that's not going to happen to me. Right.
Right. Famous last words, to say the least. Yes, I've eaten a lot of those. So, and lastly, tell me about a time when you had to laugh at yourself.
Well, I just had that experience last night. We were holding an offsite for the company, and we had a retirement dinner for a colleague who was stepping down. And I'm the one who was responsible for picking the restaurant. Mm-hmm. And the restaurant I chose was on the Hudson River. So that was very nice.
Beautiful.
However, it was a converted train station. So again, that all sounded fun. We got there and we were sitting outside with our group of 35 people. And the train station is still actively used as a commuter train station.
Whoops.
And so trains were coming up maybe 20 yards from where we were sitting and stopping. People were getting off and walking by us, you know, to go to their cars. And other trains were zooming by because they weren't making that stop. And it was a little...
Loud?
Well, it was loud. It was disruptive. But in the end, nobody really was that bothered by it. And sometimes you just have to turn what could have been a negative into a positive, right?
Yeah.
Hey, having this party at an old train station, isn't this fun?
Right. Isn't this fun?
Right.
Yes. I meant to do that.
I'm sorry you couldn't hear me when we were talking. Let me say, in fact, I think we were giving some speeches when some of the trains were going by, and it was a little hard for everybody to hear.
I would imagine. What was the immediate thought that went through your head when the very first train went whizzing past?
Oh, no. This could be a problem. But then I turned it into a positive. I said to my colleagues, well, this is a lot better than being inside where it's dark and gloomy. We're all outside and the weather's nice and we can see the Hudson River and it's beautiful.
Beautiful. And sound effects and full 3D, 4D physical experience involved when your table and everything else is rattling. Hold on to your drinks, folks. Here we go.
Right. Exactly.
Oh, that's terrific. Reed, tell us how people can learn more about you and your company.
Well, we have what I think is a terrific website, www.dp.oaklins.com. That tells a lot about who we are, what we do, shares bios of my colleagues. And so that's probably the best way.
I think that's terrific. And of course, we'll put that in the show notes as well. Thank you so much for joining us today, Reed. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you, Laura. That was a great conversation. I really appreciate it. And thanks to all the listeners that are tuning in.
You just beat me to it. I was going to do the exact same thing.
Sorry.
That's wonderful. No, nothing to be sorry about at all. I'm glad that you had as much fun as I did.
I did.
To everybody else out there. Of course, thank you for tuning in. As always, be sure to subscribe so that you never miss an episode. And once again, don't forget to leave us that 5-star rating so that we can help even more people to increase their confidence, presence, and influence. And finally, if you want to download my free guide to equipment recommendations for virtual influence, including my picks for microphones, lights, and more, go to speakingtoinfluence.com. I'm Dr. Laura Sokola, and you're listening to Speaking to Influence, communication secrets of the C-suite.
Thanks for listening to Speaking to Influence, communication secrets of the C-suite, the show for leaders who want to speak with impact. The hosts, producers, owners, and media distributors of the show make no guarantees that the strategies and information discussed will result in profit or other success and may result in losses. The opinions and statements of the hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the owners, staff, managers, broadcasters, or sponsors of the show. No medical or psychological therapy or personal or professional wellness or relationship advice is offered in the show. You are advised to seek counsel on matters related to your health, family, relationships, job, or other business and legal matters from licensed advisors in those areas prior to making any changes in business or lifestyle. No information provided may be suitable in your situation. As always, take responsibility for the decisions and actions you take, including the reactions they may make in your work, family, health, and life.